look, up on the screen, or over there in the bookstore. It's a superhero. It's lots and lots of superheroes. Holy pop culture, what's going on? The whole country has been learning the secret that's been kept alive for years by a core group of comic book fans, the classic superhero stories, as they continue to be produced by some of the best writers and artists alive, can be wildly fun, suspenseful, exciting, and even profoundly thought-provoking. Like Plato and Aristotle, Superman and Batman are here to stay. So are Spider-Man, Daredevil, the Fantastic Four, and the uncanny X-Men, among other mythic heroes in tights. One of the most striking pop culture developments of the present day is the strong resurgence of the costumed superhero as an entertainment and cultural icon. A recent nationally syndicated newspaper article on this turn of events began with the sweeping sentence, "It's become a comic book world." The global reference is appropriate. Not many fictional characters in history have attained anything like the international recognition of Superman and Batman. These two titans of the comics have inspired radio, television, film, and musical depictions since their first appearances in the late 1930s. You can see someone wearing a Superman or Batman t-shirt in almost any part of the world and under some of the most extraordinary circumstances. Now, many of their junior colleagues are being featured on the big screen, and some of them are becoming huge film and merchandising franchises themselves. The first Spider-Man movie surprised the film community with the single largest U.S. opening weekend gross revenues in history, and Spider-Man 2 topped even that in worldwide box office receipts. Over the coming years, this trend is predicted to continue, with sequels, long-awaited launches, and films being made on lesser-known superhero characters, as well as all the major icons. Superheroes have become a part of our cultural language. Perpetually popular Seinfeld reruns often showcase esoteric discussions between Jerry and George over some bit of superhero trivia. The theme song for the popular NBC comedy Scrubs casually referenced Superman. Contemporary rock, rap, and pop music all contain allusions to the spandex crowd. Comic book shops dot the landscapes of big cities, suburbs, and small-town strip malls, bringing together an amazing array of fans. And the larger comic book conventions held around the country annually, once hosting hundreds of participants, have in the past few years reached an all-time peak attendance, with the flagship San Diego convention recently enjoying a crowd of 87,000 fans over 3 or 4 days. What's even more important is that current aficionados of the comic book superheroes include some of the hottest opinion makers and trendsetters of the day, with top box office megastars vying to be cast as their superhero favorites, respected novelists sprinkling their narratives with superhero references, and at least one celebrated film director, the ever-inventive Kevin Smith, actually writing some very popular superhero comic books himself. The best superhero comics, in addition to being tremendously entertaining, introduce and treat in vivid ways some of the most interesting and important questions facing all human beings. Questions regarding ethics, personal and social responsibility, justice, crime and punishment, the mind and human emotions, and more. It's about time that the best comic books got their due and were more widely recognized for their innovative and intriguing ways of raising and wrestling with these pressing human concerns. All that from the study Superheroes and Philosophy by Tom Morris and Matt Morris, issued by Open Court. As it happens, the Everhart Museum in Scranton has been taken over by superheroes and, beware, by supervillains. In an exhibition titled, "Here I Come to Save the Day, the Science, Culture, and Art of Superheroes," the show just opened and will run through July 17th with a specially themed event on February 23rd. Deshka Pfeiffer is the curator, and she stopped in at the WVIA studios with Stephanie Colarusso, the Everhart's Director of Interpretive Programs, to talk with us about superheroes.
We love apparently exploring narrative at the Everhart Museum, and now we're looking at sequential visual narrative, which is what comics are, and specifically the comic creations of superheroes and supervillains. And the main reason we decided to explore this subject is because we know comics are extremely popular. Superheroes and supervillains have seen quite a resurgence in the movie franchising and the TV franchising that's been happening with the two big publishers. But just in general, comics readership is up. And we have such a great science collection that we thought we would explore animal-based superheroes and villains using our taxidermy.
When we think of comics, just because there is a graphic element in addition to the text, do we think it's then simplified in some way?
I think generally anything that looks graphic or is drawn immediately is targeted as being something only oriented towards youth, and because that's how they more easily absorb stories. But in fact, sequential visual storytelling is an ancient human art. The earliest cave paintings were basically stories being told in sequential steps. And the same goes with other ancient rock art and cave art around the world. So it's a very human way to tell a story. And what happened was with the advent of printing and literacy growth in the 18th century, artists started creating panels as opposed to just single illustrations. They started telling stories based with several illustrations in a row. And William Hogarth is kind of credited for creating the first comic in the sense that he created a series of prints that told the story of a rake's progress and a harlot's progress. So basically their corruption arcs. And then proceeded to make a mint selling these prints because they were so easily reproducible and people could acquire them. And there was humor as well as a moralistic kind of story behind it. And so I think a lot of people just think that that's what kids absorb. But in fact, it's meant for every age group. And comics have grown in complexity. They're not just about very bold printing colors and simple black and white storylines, particularly since the 1980s. The concept of dark, gritty superheroes or conflicted anti-heroes have really played a larger role in sort of the consciousness. When you look at the superhero genre, the concept that they're vigilantes and, you know, maybe they're superseding what they should really be doing in our society. You know, graphic novels like The Watchmen kind of touch upon that sort of thing. So I think the complexity has grown as well as people's appreciation of the complexity. And often the true comic book fans tend to be fans throughout their lives. It's not just something that stays just with kids. Granted, it still tends to be male-dominated, but with the amount of young women reading and young women also writing and drawing comics, people are starting to realize, and publishers are starting to realize, that different types of representation are required and needed and necessary. So more and more voices are given the opportunity to tell their stories through comics. And so for some very key figures, for example, like the Black Panther, was created in 1966, the first black superhero from Marvel, got a brand new reboot with comics, a new writer, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is writing the stories, and very well-known African-American artist is drawing the comic books, Brian Steelfreeze, and there's going to be a movie next year. So we know that besides the fact that the character was extremely technologically advanced, intelligent, powerful, capable, that character was also representing, for African Americans, someone they had not seen in comics before. And so that's really, really important part of the storytelling, is to show the diversity and not just one type of person that can be a hero.
What do we find in terms of animal representation in comics early on?
Probably the very first, most people credit the first superhero as being Superman. But in fact, if you look at the Pulp Fiction comics of the 30s, the very first personification of a vigilante hero, even if this person didn't have superpowers, was a bat. The Black Bat, the Bat, all from the mid to late 30s. And so Batman, Bob Kane's Batman, really grew out of those characters and took on that vigilante, dark, a fearful quality, using the imagery of the bat as a nocturnal creature to, you know, create doom and gloom, very much paved the way to create what is Batman. And Batman was only created about a year after Superman, but really the bat was the first kind of superhero. So the animal world has always been an important influence. And in fact, as you look through the chronology of how the development of the superheroes and supervillains, usually whatever was sort of popular in the news at that specific moment in time in science or in nature studies would get developed as a character. And so that's how you end up with a porcupine and an armadillo and probably also a black panther, as well as a few other creatures. Birds, particularly, some of the earliest hawk man, hawk girl have this Egyptian storyline and they're hawks. There's also vultures and condors, foxes, mice, turtles, all being taken over for superhero or supervillain personae.
You mentioned the collection at the Everhart. What's the source, various sources of these specimens?
We know that for the majority of the birds, our founder, Isaiah Everhart, probably collected them. We know that, in fact, the California condor we have on display right now as part of the exhibition, because there was a hero called the Black Condor, was actually collected in the Pacific Northwest in the 1890s before they were endangered and so forth. So other birds, other parts of the collection, the mammals, reptiles, probably came from other sources and other naturalist friends. Unfortunately, we don't always have the paperwork to back that up, but we do know that they came into the collection, you know, in the early part of the 20th century.
Then what are the various elements of the way you tell this larger story?
We cover a lot of material.
We're doing a lot of guided tours starting now until, you know, school season is over and even into the summer. So in a half an hour, we're able to really use the timeline throughout U.S. history even to tell a story that kind of parallels the comic book heroes and where and when they were created. So it's pretty interesting. There's actually three ages, golden, silver, and bronze. And of course, the modern age is right now, the present day. So we're following those ages in time, but also with the U.S. history connected. There's just a great flow to each of the spaces, and Nashka and Renee, her assistant curator, have really done a wonderful job of putting the information together. So the first room is actually fully the golden age, which takes place between 1939 and 1956.
Yeah.
The next space is all silver. And the final space are bronze and modern. So you can really tour each of the spaces and get a great story within each of those spaces.
Do you have the original comics on display?
Well, we have some original comic art, you know, for some of the actual panels that would have been used to create the final printed product, thanks to Mark Schultz and Corey Williamson, who lent some of their collection. Corey is the widow of Al Williamson, who's a very well-known inker and penciler, and Mark Schultz is a local, nationally and internationally renowned cartoonist and writer. And we also worked with Comics on the Green, Dave Romeo Jr., and he helped by lending a whole slew of the original comic books. As often as possible, we were able to pair our specimen with a comic book, at least one comic book of the hero or villain.
Mock-ups of Batman or things like that that are 3D?
We have some merchandising, you know, because a lot of people see superheroes in as alarm clocks or action figures, mm-hmm. or, you know, things like that. But a main element of the 3D work, which also aids in interpretation to the show, is the contemporary art. So we have some really fabulous paintings, sculptures that are just really, really creative in how the artist was interpreting superheroes or supervillains.
And Steph, we always mm-hmm. know that you have such a wonderful educational outreach program at the Everhart. Do you have workshops and things?
Sure. We have workshops that actually just started last week, Everhart 101, which is a partnership with Keystone College. The educators actually teach the classes. So all of the classes are themed to superheroes. But we also have Where Nature and Science Collide, which will start in May. And we have a community day, April 22nd, which is probably one of our biggest days of the year. We do free admission for everyone that comes through the doors. And from 1 to 4, we have several artists or presentations or activities for all ages to take part in.
Since the doors have opened on this show, have you been pleasantly surprised?
Yes, we actually had a great opening weekend because the show only just opened. People were very excited to see this subject coming up because I think superheroes play such a role in just general daily culture. Like, we use these characters as metaphors regularly in our own lives, and I think a lot of people have people in their lives who are huge comic book fans. So it's something that we're hoping, in looking at, we're fostering also literacy, because comics help particularly children with learning disabilities tackle reading in a way that, because they're able to fuse the images and text, they're then able to kind of grasp another element of the story. And I think that's really important, that people realize that reading isn't this passive thing, it's actually this active role that you play. And I think those are some of the things that Stephanie's certainly featuring with some of the stories they're telling, and even the nature of printing itself, like why comics look the way that they do.
Yeah, the four color printing process is actually highlighted in one of the collection items.
We have a wonderful piece. It's a piece of print Valiant, and there's a CMYK separations, so the acetate separations, the bright blue, bright magenta, bright yellow. You can actually see how when they're overlaid, they spit out the color that's supposed to look like when the final product is completed.
So really, it's so interesting to see not only how a comic book was created and what the use was for entertainment originally, but then just how it's transformed. So it's really, really an interesting exhibit.
Take us into the world of the contemporary artists taking part. Pick one or a couple and talk to us about what a couple of them might be up to.
Well, we have 12 of them in the exhibition, and one of them is really taken the personification of superheroes on. I think his name is Mark Newport. He has this beautiful quilt that he made where he literally sewed comic books together in honor of his son's birth back in 2000 and embroidered the figures and silhouette of Batman or Captain America and a handful of other characters that appear. And a lot of the imagery that you see in the comic books that were chosen in the pages feature fathers and sons. And then he has these fabulous Sweaterman suits, which I think are extremely eye-catching and a little
Most popular is Argyle Man so far.
He actually created a suit that looked like a Batman, so you could look like he hand-knits the suits. And then there's one called Sweaterman, which is red and blue. Argyle Man is literally, like, he's got an Argyle pattern, and it's an entire full-body bodysuit with a kind of a balaclava-type mask attached on the top. And then the pink one is awesome because it's Bobble Man. And so if you know how to knit and you know how to create baubles, the suit is just completely covered in baubles. There's an artist, Ryan Humphrey, who we featured in the skateboarding exhibition, and he shared a Superman series of himself sort of turning into Superman. And he shared the work of Sean Leonardo, who's a wonderful artist from New York as well, who has personified himself as a luchador, you know, the Mexican wrestler type of character. So we're actually able to talk about luchador wrestling and masks as important parts of identities for superheroes as well as for luchadors, and sort of brings in another cultural element to the whole concept. So all of the artists have really gotten some really wonderful responses. Catherine Bradford paints these beautifully colorful, almost ephemeral figures of Superman. She has several paintings of Superman that she lent us, including one of them called Superman Alone, where he's sort of standing at the top of the world and in his strong pose. And he's very, just those iconic colors of that suit, and, you know, you see him snapping on his spandex and saving the day.
Jeffrey Kent, too.
Jeffrey Kent.
Jeffrey Kent was featured in our Altered Books exhibit last year, and his work really talks about literacy and maybe even trouble reading. So the text is actually painted backwards. So looking at it, at first, you can, you know, see it's obviously text, but when you step up close and try to read it, it is difficult. So he's talking about
those kinds of challenges, you know, in reading and having dyslexia or having learning disabilities, and also kind of how that puts you in a point of vulnerability. The community day that Stephanie mentioned on April 22nd will feature some really wonderful cosplay elements.
Yes. And if you don't know what cosplay is, it's costumed role-playing. So you actually can take on an identity, whether it be of a character that's in comics or something you make up on your own.
Because people tend to have a favorite superhero. You know, it's just something you can usually ask somebody what is in their back pocket and their ideas. But it's also something that we see image-wise around us in advertising. You don't even have to be going to the movies or watching television. Those kinds of comments and references are made all the time. And we actually worked with a street artist named Myth, who created some interactive pieces for us. So you can actually come to the museum, take shots of the show while you're there, but also take pictures of yourself in one of those standee cutouts as either Catwoman or one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and post it online on Instagram or on Twitter.
Hashtag
Myth New York or hashtag Myths Heroes. And then, of course, always hashtag EM Superheroes.
Were you struck, for example, by pulling out the condor or pulling out some of the turtles and then looking at the comic image and saying, did that artist nail that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we actually started with the comics first because we knew there's a pretty succinct chronology as to when all of these creatures kind of came onto the scene. So we knew we wanted to tell that chronology story, that we needed to use that outline. And so it was interesting to see the armadillo from the 1970s, who actually becomes a luchador wrestler, so that's another reason we're able to reference the luchador tradition, lucha libre tradition, then to see how he's got the scales and the claws and and he does actually look like that animal. And often the origin story for the character includes a fusion of DNA, you know, so they're getting fused with porcupine DNA or, you know, armadillo DNA or some other kind of DNA. And they then take on those personas and physical characteristics. So, for example, like Batman, even though Batman himself does not have superpowers and doesn't look like a bat, he has a kind of quasi-villain, you know, character in the series called Man-Bat, whose body was, in fact, fused with bat DNA to sort of overcome a disability of his. And he, in fact, does look like a bat monster, unfortunately for him. And so it's interesting to see kind of how the writers and the artists tweak those elements and then create something slightly different.
And we know from your blood exhibition that you have bats.
Yes, we do. Yes, we have. We actually did bring out a couple bats. We have quite a few specimens out, really. Quite a lot of our birds came out because eagles, hawks, falcons.
We also have insects. We can't forget about them. They're small, but they're mighty.
There are a lot of bug-related heroes and villains. Spider-Man, of course. And then there's a whole slew. Queen Bee, Insect Queen, the Scorpion, Ant-Man. Swarm, who's a villain.
Again, you mentioned that your collection was assembled in a way well before the concerns with their habitat and endangered.
Yes, for the most part, yes. I think probably in some cases, some of that was already in concern, you know, particularly thinking about what happened with the condors in California in the early part of the 20th century, knowing that they were endangered. So it's possible by 1890 when Everhart was collecting them, they may have already been concerned that the numbers weren't as great as they could have been, because they probably had been hunting them for quite some time at that point, decades at least, you know, since people had moved to California, naturalists. So I think that is definitely a role that even the comics artists, you know, and writers are often considering, is when they're choosing an animal, is that they're highlighting some other element there.
Is there anything specifically in terms of events that you'd like to make sure that our listeners know about?
Yes, very exciting. We have an event coming up February 23rd. It's one of our tasting events that we do probably once a year at this point, but it's called Super Taste and Villainous Sips. So we have a peculiar chef, Gene Philbin, and his wife, Miranda, and David and Rosemary Falchuk from the American Wine Society presenting. And what they're doing is really interesting. It's when you think of even the Silver Age of superheroes, you think of the science heroes. So they're taking molecular gastronomy and molecular mixology and pairing them up with a superhero taste, so food, but the villain that goes with it in the drink. So it's really going to be cool. And then March 23rd, we're doing an event that we actually have done before, but it's been 10 years since we've done it. It's called Everhart After Dark. And really, it's just a night to experience the museum. You can dress up if you'd like to. We are highly recommending dressing up. It starts at 6 p.m. and we'll have music and drinks, but we also have a game room set up and an activity for people to take part in. Tour the whole museum. The whole museum will be open that night. And like I said, different areas will have different activities, music, drinks, games, you name it, it'll be fun.
And we've just had a snow event that made things hard for people to get to the museum.
We had scheduled on February 9th a special panel to discuss John Willard Rott and his paintings, the exhibition that we've got up right now until March 27th, to really sort of explore how the environment impacted his paintings and subject matter, as well as what we can still learn from him in relation to his northeastern Pennsylvania landscape paintings, whether they feature, you know, bucolic landscapes or coal breakers. And the evening of dialogue includes, you know, some really wonderful community partners that we work with pretty regularly. Maureen McGuigan from the county, Bernie McGurl from Lackawanna River Corridor, Natalie Gelb from Lackawanna Valley Heritage, and Richard Stanislaus, who's the former curator with the PHMC. And all of them have expertise in whether it's the environment or art, and in figuring out how to interpret Rott, you know, for a new age, really, I think is what we're hoping. We're gonna see what some ideas may come out.
So you've rescheduled that for
March 16th.
How long do we have to see Superheroes?
Superheroes is on view until July 17th, so it's a nice long run. And we're also, Stephanie has created some other really great events, so we're going to keep interpreting as we go along until the exhibition closes.
And we can find out about the events online at
www.everhart-museum.org.
Curator Neshka Pfeiffer, and Stephanie Colarusso, the Everhart's director of interpretive programs, speaking with us about the current exhibition, Here I Come to Save the Day, The Science, Culture, and Art of Superheroes. The show just opened and will run through July 17th with a specially themed event on Thursday, February 23rd, so next week, February 23rd, Super Tastes and Villainous Sips. And that gets underway at 6 o'clock. It's an evening of molecular food and drink pairings with Jean Philbin and Miranda Philbin from the Peculiar Culinary Company, and also Rosemary and David Falchek from the American Wine Society. Each pairing will feature a comic superhero and that comic superhero's nemesis. And for more information, check the website at everhart-museum.org, everhart-museum.org, and Everhart is spelled E-V-E-R-H-A-R-T. And the Everhart Museum is located at Naog Park in Scranton, 1901 Mulberry Street. And for more information on the web, everhart-museum.org. It's Here I Come to Save the Day, The Science, Culture, and Art of Superheroes, now through July 17th.